Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Plan Sponsor Compliance Conference Call. We will take questions at the end of today's presentation, and instructions will be provided at that time. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Heather Abrego. Please go ahead, ma'am.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, thank you, everybody, for attending our third Plan Sponsor Compliance Audiocast. We're thrilled to have you. So hopefully you received our invitation, which is why you're here today, and we thought we would talk about something that everybody wants to talk about. And I think it's particularly important because right now is committee season. A lot of the committees are meeting. It's that quarterly review, and I just so happen to have one today and tomorrow. So I'm, in case you didn't know, I am Heather Abrego. I'm here with Summer. One of us has coffee and one of us has water. I'm going to let you decide at the end of this who has who. All right, so I thought what we would do is kind of get started on a very basic overview of who is a fiduciary and kind of the general process. We're not going to bore you to death, but just kind of make sure we're all on the same playing field. So clearly, you know, plan sponsors have a fiduciary responsibility, and that fiduciary responsibility includes selecting and monitoring service providers. One of the things that we want to make sure that everybody understands is, you know, there's also this different levels of fiduciary status, and we're not going to go too much into it because I think we've discussed it before, but, you know, there's some level at the plan committee level and also the board. But with respect to our conversations today, we're going to really talk about the plan committee and what their responsibilities are. A lot of times you'll hear us ERISA attorney slash geeks talk about how do you satisfy your responsibilities, and especially with respect to selecting and monitoring service providers. You're going to hear this word a lot. I think process is kind of this number one theme. I know you say it a lot, don't you?
Yeah, process is what I constantly say, because I think that's one of the most key points as far as making fiduciary decisions. The rules don't require that you always make the right decision or pick the best service provider or the best investment option. What they require is that you have gone through a prudent process in making the decision that you made. And so it's vital that you go through that process and that you document that process. So sometimes I feel like a broken record when I say that it's important to go through that process and document that process.
And I think also because a lot of plan sponsors, they want to hear kind of this, you know, black and white rule as to, well, what do I need to do and how do I need to do it? And it's always, you know, for those that have been fortunately involved in Department of Labor investigations, there is no bright line rule as to what you have to do. It's this idea of what did you do and how did you make the decision. So let me just kind of go through some of the ideas of what is a prudent process. So, and the reason you want to do this is because you want to establish that you actually had a process, that you had reasoning behind the decisions that were made from a plan sponsor and plan committee perspective. So the number one thing is you want to gather, whenever you're making a decision about something, whether it be about going with this service provider, choosing this investment, you first want to gather the relevant information. And who are you going to gather that from? Well, you're either going to gather it on your own as a committee, or you're going to gather it from the folks that you've hired to help you make fiduciary decisions. So, for example, your investment advisor, if it's about an investment, you're going to ask him or her to provide you with reports and financial statements and all that kind of information that you need to be able to make the decision. The second thing you're going to want to do is analyze the information. Well, what does that mean? Obviously, everybody on the committee is not an investment expert. Obviously, everybody on the committee doesn't know everything about everything they're supposed to know. So go out and get help. Go out and ask your investment advisors, your record keepers, and ask us, the ERISA attorneys, to come in and help you analyze the information, explain the information. The number one thing I think that's really important for plan sponsors and plan committees to do is not just to get the information and plop it in front of them and then just take the advice of whoever, you know, the investment advisor. Actually look at the information, listen to the advice, and make sure you understand it. And once you've done those two things, then you can make a decision based on the information that you reviewed. So, you know, again, to be the broken record, that's kind of your process. As simple as that sounds, what happens, and especially nowadays in committee meetings that have kind of standard agendas, the committee members kind of rely on those agendas and kind of go through this you know, automated process where it's like, okay, for the first hour we're going to look at, you know, the investment report, and they're going to have somebody talk to them for an hour and maybe suggest changes in the investment. But they actually don't take the time to review the materials to really understand, well, why is this investment not so good versus this investment? And they just kind of make the decision based on the recommendation of the advisor. And while it's always important to have an advisor and consultant be there to explain things, it's also up to the committee has to understand why are they making that decision and based on the information before them. So I think the three things, you know, is gather the information, analyze the information, and just make a decision based on that information.
And then, as I said before, two other, I guess, follow-up points of that. One, obviously, you want to make sure you're documenting that process and decision. And then the other thing to keep in mind is this is an ongoing duty. So, you know, a committee goes through an RFP process to pick a new record keeper, and that can be a, you know, time and labor intensive process and involve a lot of reviewing information and going through all this, and gosh, you get through the whole RFP process and you think, phew, I'm done, glad that's over. But what you really need to remember is that there's an ongoing duty. Once you, it's not just a duty with respect to selecting the search providers, there's a duty to select and monitor them. So once you've gone through that whole RFP process, you still have a duty to kind of keep an ongoing eye on what the search provider is doing to make sure that they're providing the services that you are expecting and that the fee you're paying for the services you're getting is reasonable. And so while you don't need to do an RFP certainly every year, you know, you do an RFP every few years, but even in between that time, you should be doing benchmarking or at least discussing on an annual basis what the services are, how the services are going. Are you happy with what's being provided to you? Or has there been information out there that makes you think you should re-examine that search provider? You know, different, you know, things that might come out in the news if you want to take a look at that search provider and whether or not it continues to make sense. So it's both a duty to select and to do some ongoing monitoring.
And I think that, you know what, the number one thing after you've done that, and it's wonderful and great and fantastic when you do that, the worst thing you can do is do that and not document it. So there is a whole art, isn't there a book, Art of War?
Right.
There's an art of committee meeting.
Art of minute taking.
And I can tell you how many times I've written the committee meeting minutes, and I've actually redrafted my own meeting minutes. But there really is, you need to document that process, because 5, 6, 7 years down the road, when there might be an issue about a decision you made, number one, committee members might not be there. Number two, you're never going to remember why exactly you made that decision. And number three, you kind of need that as backup. But without going into that too much, you know, there definitely is an art to writing those minutes. You don't want to include too much, but you don't want to leave out too much. So I think that is a whole separate audio cast. Maybe we'll
do that in the future.
Yeah, we'll
do
that one.
Eye out for that
one. Go. So, all right. So those are kind of your fiduciary responsibilities. I know, Summer, you have some thoughts about what kind of service providers are out there. And
yeah, and that's another thing. I think a lot of times, you know, obviously the record keeper is kind of one of the main search providers people are thinking about as far as reviewing periodically and documenting the fees. And there's been a lot of changes in the world as far as how the fees get disclosed and how they're calculated and determined, and a lot of issues. And we can talk about those. But it's important to remember, I think, that there are other search providers that need to be considered as well. Typically, a committee will hire an investment advisor to help them make decisions as far as what investment options they're going to include in the investment lineup. And so selecting that investment advisor is a fiduciary duty, and so there's a duty to select and to continue monitoring that investment advisor. And that's going to be true whether the investment advisor is considered a 316 versus a 321 investment advisor. And I'll touch on that just briefly. Basically, you typically see investment advisors providing services in one of two capacities. Sometimes they are what's called a non-discretionary investment advisor, often referred to as a 321. And that's probably what we see most typically in the 401k plan world, which is where the investment advisor is a fiduciary to the plan, and they are coming and they are giving recommendations to the committee as far as what investment options to include in the lineup. But the investment advisor is not making the final decision. The final decision is still up to the committee. And so the committee has the fiduciary responsibility to make those decisions and make sure they've gone through the right process in making that decision. On the other hand, you sometimes see a discretionary investment manager, sometimes referred to as a 316, and that's where the committee has essentially delegated away the authority to select the investment options and gives that authority to the investment manager. So the investment manager is still a fiduciary, but in that case, they're actually the fiduciary making those decisions. Oftentimes, committees will do that in order to try to reduce some of their potential fiduciary liability with respect to selecting investment options. But it's really important that the committee remember that while they may have delegated away the fiduciary responsibility for selecting those investment options, they still have the fiduciary liability and responsibility to select and monitor that investment manager to make sure that they are providing services appropriately. So that's one thing to think about when you are selecting service providers. And then it also holds true with other advisors or other service providers to the plan. We've seen a lot come out recently with respect to plan auditors. And so when the committee is selecting the plan auditor, I think that's still also a fiduciary responsibility. And it's really important to take a close look at those auditors that you're selecting because they play a very important role as far as reviewing and auditing the plan, and oftentimes they can help in the sense of finding problems that you can then fix, because it's always better if you find the problems internally or with the help of an auditor rather than the DOL or IRS finding the problem so that you can fix it before that happens.
But I think the DOL is perfectly happy finding the problems.
Yeah. If you don't want to, don't worry. They're there for you. We'd like to avoid that. But I know, and speaking of the DOL, they have issued a report kind of looking at auditors and realized that, you know, it's important to consider how much plan experience the auditors have. As far as the DOL's report, they've basically come to the determination in that the fewer plans that auditor is responsible for and the less experience they have, the much more frequently there's an improper, invalid, or incorrect audit. And so that's important when you're looking at your and selecting your auditor to make sure that you've got one who's got sufficient benefit plan experience.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think a lot of the auditors now with the 2016 plan year ending have really kind of expanded the scope of their audit. So I think a lot of plan sponsors are seeing questions being asked that they never thought before. So that's an important factor to look at, is what is the scope of services that your auditor is providing.
And I know, especially like the HR people who are dealing with those plan auditors, sometimes get frustrated with the amount of questions that they're getting asked. But like I said, I think it's much better if the auditors determine that there's a problem so that you have the opportunity to fix it before the IRS or the DOL does. But so that's just another service provider that's important to consider as you're going through the process of selecting. So I think the top three are probably the record keeper, investment advisor, and auditor.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you see consultants, attorneys, other resource providers as well should be considered.
Yeah.
Another thing to keep in mind as you are delegating responsibilities to a service provider is kind of along the lines of monitoring. The IRS and the DOL have both said like there are certain responsibilities that the plan administrator has. It's perfectly acceptable to delegate and have a service provider perform those services for you, but that doesn't mean you get off the hook if they do something wrong. And so loan provisions and hardship provisions, for example, there are plan requirements and that must be followed, and you don't get off the hook if there's a problem by just saying, oh, the service provider did it, they did it wrong. You have an obligation to check and make sure that they have the correct policies in place and they're actually doing things appropriately and doing things that you are supposed to be doing.
But, of course, nothing ever happens with loans and hard. They never go wrong.
Never, never.
That was sarcastic, by the way. Anybody. And, yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest things is when, you know, especially loans, I've seen a lot of problems lately with loans. And what ends up happening is that, well, you know, we relied on them to, you know, do this or default, I think, is kind of a big issue. You know, we thought they were handling all that. And the problem with that is, yeah, even though your service provider said they were handling the loan default issues, at the end of the day, the correction is up to the employer. And to be honest with you, the IRS doesn't really care who made the mistake. it's still going to be the plan sponsor who has to fix it. So that's something I wanted to point out, because I don't know why, but I've seen loans become an issue in the last, I would say, probably 2 years, more than hardship distribution.
Yeah, loans have been a big issue. I know we've had the IRS a number of times, and maybe we're getting off topic here, but where they raise the issue of whether or not you're getting the proper documentation, especially if you're doing a 30-year residential loan as opposed to a 5-year loan. So, you know, there's obviously tons of great record keepers out there. They do their job, but the committee also has a job to make sure that those record keepers are doing what they said they do and what they're supposed to be doing to comply with the rules.
Yep. All right, that's a whole other topic, loans.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, that'll be our fifth. We're just going to add, we're going to add down the road all the other issues. All right. 408B2 disclosures, I mean, you've all heard about 408B2. It's been around for a while now.
And if you haven't called.
That's kind of a problem. But essentially, you know, a number of years ago, the DOL started to realize that fees weren't all that clear in the plan benefit plan world. And they really need to be clear so that the committee can make the review all the information and make a fiduciary decision regarding selecting their service providers. And so the DOL came out with these 408B2 rules that essentially, and I'm not going to get into the whole detail, but essentially, in order to make sure that you don't have a prohibited transaction when selecting and using a service provider, the service provider is required to make what's called 408B2 disclosures to the fiduciary responsible for selecting them. That's going to include information about the fees they charge, compensation they might receive from other third parties, services, and whether or not they are fiduciaries. And while this is typically viewed as an obligation on the service provider to make those disclosures, by definition, essentially, if they're making those disclosures, then the committee has, or the fiduciary responsible for selecting that service provider, has the duty to review those disclosures, make sure they've gotten, at least from what they can tell, all the information that they're supposed to get, and that they have used that information when making their decisions as far as selecting the service providers. I've had a number of people say, well, I didn't get my annual 408B2 disclosure, and so there, just to be clear, there's not an annual disclosure requirement. Essentially, from a 408B2 standpoint, the service provider is supposed to provide the disclosures before they're selected, so the committee has the information to make that decision, and then they don't have to make another disclosure until there's a change. So if there's a change in the services or a change in the fee being charged or the compensation they're receiving, at that point they're supposed to provide a change notice to the committee. And so anytime the committee gets a change notice like that, that's the time to review that and make sure that it's appropriate and reasonable given the circumstances. And I think that's, I mean, the 408B2 notices, again, I mean, that's part of the fiduciary responsibility of the plan committee to review them and make sure that they're adequate. I've noticed lately that what will happen is, let's say, for example, there's a change in the plan demographics or there's a merger or something like that, the record keeper might just send over a new agreement, you know, which, so you may not see kind of a change agreement. They consider just a new agreement, and you have to kind of decipher what is the new information and what is the change. I think some actual service providers, you know, might actually send like annual notices. What they tend to do is with the, you know, participant disclosures, the 404A5 notices, sometimes say this is also your 408B2 update. So it can be a tricky world, you know, in deciding if you've received the adequate disclosures. But again, there's a fiduciary responsibility to make sure you get them, you understand them, and then based on that information, you make a decision as to whether it's reasonable to keep that service provider or, you know, what things you should be doing. So
right. And Heather makes a key point there as far as the services and fees are reasonable. I'm sure you've heard us say it before. You are not required. There's no requirement that you pick the cheapest service provider out there. The requirement is that you are paying a reasonable fee for the services you're getting. And so it doesn't have to be the cheapest, but you need to be able to determine that it's reasonable for what you're getting.
Yep.
For the most part, we've been focusing on 401Ks, and part of that is because, you know, or at least 401Ks and 403Bs, those are the ones that are in the spotlight these days with so much litigation going on.
mostly alleging fee issues for the most part. And we also have 482. So we've really had some highlighting on the fee aspects and the service provider aspects with respect to retirement plans. But I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that welfare plans are also subject to ERISA and subject to these fiduciary responsibilities. And so when you're selecting the service providers for your welfare plans, you need to be thinking about these same processes and going through and gathering all the information and reviewing it and making decisions. I think so often employers pay a good chunk of the coverage, of the cost for health and welfare coverage, but there are still amounts that get paid by participants as well. And so it's really important to make sure that you're going through these processes and considering from a fiduciary responsibility standpoint whether or not the welfare service providers are reasonable as well.
Yeah, no, that's a really important point. I mean, I spoke with Gene Hackerman about a year and a half ago at a conference, and we were talking about fee law investigations. I thought we were there mostly to talk about 401k plans, but Gene, who was at the time prior to retirement, I think she was the regional director for enforcement, she basically talked the whole time about health and welfare plans and the fiduciary responsibilities that are connected to health and welfare plans and mostly health plans and how they were, you know, ramping up investigations, and I think we're seeing that more and more. So sometimes health and welfare plans are like the stepsister, the stepchild. They get pushed aside, but I think we're going to start to see a lot more focus, and so it's really important that plan sponsors realize that there is and there are duties with respect to the health plans. And we actually had a meeting. It was an interesting concept because how do you, I mean, and we're going to go into what are some of the options, you know, when selecting the service provider and how do you figure that out. But there isn't a whole lot out there for health and welfare plans. And we had a visit where there was this idea of a transparent auction. It was something that was really interesting to me. And at the time, I know they were focused, when they came in and talked to us, the focus about life and disability plans, but it's the idea of what they called a transparent reverse auction. And so what they would do is that they would basically have the providers and insurance carriers come in and everybody could see everything and basically bid on, you know, let's say you wanted a life insurance plan for your company and they would bid on it. And everybody could see everybody else's offerings and price and everything like that. And then what they would do is they would do a secondary rebid. It's almost like an auction. And they would come in and everybody would then, you know, the insurance carriers would give their then lowest price again. And then, you know, there would be a winner. So it was just something that I thought, and this was specific to life and disability. And I think it could be probably, you know, I think they're starting to open it up for, you know, other types of insurance. But these kind of creative ideas are really interesting and I think are going to be very helpful for the health and welfare plan sponsors because, there just isn't a whole lot of, we're going to talk about benchmarking, which, you know, is a little bit less invasive than RFP.
I think RFP should really be four letters. It's more like a four-letter word to people, but it's still something that needs to be done.
Yeah, so these are kind of things that I think we're going to see a lot of more creative kind of opportunities out there on the health and welfare side. But again, what I want everyone to walk away with today is the importance of making sure that you include your health and welfare plans in the fiduciary process and making sure that you're selecting and monitoring the service providers with respect to your health and welfare. So with that said, okay, the biggest, you know, the number one question is, well, how do you do it? You know, we've talked about kind of the fiduciary responsibilities, the 482, what you're going to get disclosed, some of the information you're going to gather. But in fact, what you're all probably here to listen to is how do you actually do it? And so basically, I think the first thing we'll probably start touching on is everybody's favorite. I can't tell you how many clients I have when they talk about the RFP process. There is a immediate sigh at the beginning, and the middle, and at the end of that RFP mention. So, you know, requests for proposals are very daunting. It is a huge process. I know it's a huge headache for HR, you know, folks. But Summer, I think you've had the experience of actually attending some in-person RFPs and
I have, and I think it's something to keep in mind. So with respect to the RFP process, typically, you know, the RFP goes out, and it should generally describe and provide information about the plan, plan size, you know, demographics, various information so that the service provider can provide a response that's tailored to that particular plan. And so you'll want to provide information about the plan and what you would expect, and then obviously ask a ton of questions about the service provider so that you can understand what their capabilities are and what their services are, you know, what their experience is, how many clients they have of plans of your size, you know, all those kind of various different questions. But then I think it's also important with any service provider to do an in-person meeting. Specifically, you'll see the RFP goes out, you get a bunch of responses, and from those responses, you narrow it down to, you know, your top three or four, and then you have in-person meetings, because there's a big difference, I think, sometimes between the response you get on paper and the response you get from the people who actually come in and meet with you in person. Especially, I think it's really important that the people who are coming for that in-person RFP are the people who are actually going to be working on the plan. Because there, I know it sounds silly, but there really should be some sort of rapport between the committee in HR and the record keeper representatives and who's going to be dealing with them, everybody, so that they can understand and know. And there, sometimes I've seen, you know, they might be leaning one direction, and then when they actually meet with people in person, they realize they want to go the other direction, because I think that's the another thing to do, and sometimes this is done in the in-person meeting, sometimes it's done other times, is really taking a look at the online system and making sure that it's user-friendly, because your participants are going to be using typically this online service to see, check their account balances, and, you know, if it's not very user-friendly, that might be kind of a ding against them. So you want to make sure that you're happy and going to be satisfied with all aspects of the services that they're going to be providing.
And I think that is such an important note, because I think, you know, investment advisors and your record keepers and your TPAs that are going to be working on your plan, the idea is that they're going to be working on your plan for a while. These are the people that you are going to be dealing with sometimes on a weekly basis, you know, maybe on a daily basis, hopefully not, but, you know, right, like on a very, very regular basis, and you have to be able to, you know, see them face-to-face and be able to ascertain, is this somebody who's really going to be able to provide services? Can you communicate well with them? Because I can tell you the documentation and all the stuff that they're submitting as part of the RFP, it could be fantastic on paper, but if you get somebody in front of you that's not even able to answer your questions, or you're just kind of not, you know, gelling on the different subjects and you just feel some sort of disconnect, that is more important than the fantastic, you know, brochures and information that you're receiving from a document standpoint. So I really do recommend meeting with, you know, if you've decided, you go through the RFP process, you've decided on your top three, get those top three folks in there, you know, and really have a conversation and ask them questions about, well, what's going, you know, why are you out there for RFP? It's probably because something's happening right now that you're not happy with. Ask them how they would fix it. See, you know, what ideas they have to better your plan. What are, and these are things that, you know, are really important to do face-to-face, I feel.
I think asking for references is always a good idea, too. Now, obviously, they're probably only going to provide people who are happy with their services, but it still gives you an opportunity to talk through those references, you know, why they're happy with this service provider and what's going well so that you can determine if that's something that really matters to you and is going to help with respect to your plan. So that's another, I think, component of the RFP process that should be considered as well.
Yeah, and I mean, if you, I know a lot of service providers that I've talked to, you know, they enjoy the opportunity to participate in RFPs because it's their opportunity to put their best foot forward and actually try to get the plan sponsor's business. So all of these things that we're mentioning, the in-face, you know, show us some of your, you know, technological, you know, advances, you know, things like that, they're happy to show you, and they're, you know, they want to be able to provide kind of the best service, and that's, you know, something that I think is also really important is, you know, if you start to see some resistance, then, you know, you may right away have, you know, some issues. You don't really want to compromise when it comes to the RFPs. All right, so the second, you know, kind of going back to what Summer had talked about with the idea of RFPs, like how do you monitor the service providers? And obviously one idea is RFPs. And again, like I said, you know, our plan sponsor clients hate doing it. Unless it's something kind of really severe or there's really been a change, they really don't want to have to go through that process. So the other process they go through is something called benchmarking. And this is something probably that everybody on the call is a little bit more familiar with because, you know, this is a little bit more of a document process, and it's what I'll refer to as the correspondent IRS audit, you know, where you're just, you know, having the paper go back and forth. But it's a little bit more than that, and so we want to spend a little bit of time on it because it's important that if you are going to do the benchmarking approach, there's a couple things to keep in mind. So number one is, well, when do you do it? And I think the good, you know, rule of thumb really is to do it probably every 2 to 3 years, barring, you know, if there's any major changes. Again, if there's an increase of participants due to maybe a plan merger, if there's a decrease, maybe there's a partial plan termination, if there's any changes, obviously that rule doesn't apply because your, you know, services and your fees should be changing with respect to that. But assuming that you've had a pretty steady couple of years, I think 2 to 3 years is kind of the good ballpark measuring point in getting that done. But who's going to do it? Well, I can tell you that the committee can't. Yeah, you can do your own internal benchmark. So you're going to have to look out elsewhere. And you're going to have a lot of options out there. I know maybe even your service provider is going to say to you, okay, yeah, no problem. We can do that for you. We have the capabilities. There's a lot of third-party services out there that you can pay to also provide that to you. And even some of your consultants, your investment advisors, might have opportunities to work with those third parties, and, you know, they can sometimes help you get that. Or you could always go the route of, I think there's some online free benchmarking reports that you could get. I think one of the things you want to think about, though, with the benchmarking is, it's going to be more helpful the more specific it is to your plan. So when you're thinking about benchmarking, you want to be trying to benchmark against other plans of a similar size and demographics so that you can get a sense of whether, you know, kind of comparing apples to apples as far as looking at kind of what is out there. And again, it, you know, when you're doing the benchmarking, you want to think about the fees, and obviously, ideally, you're kind of on the low or middle side. If you are totally out of whack with what the benchmarking fees are, then you clearly want to do a closer look. But again, you know, I said before, you don't have to pick the cheapest, but you want to make sure that from a benchmarking standpoint, you're kind of at least in line with what seems reasonable relative to other similar plans. But if you are if you're an outlier, then that's the time to do some more digging and do an RFP or do a renegotiation with your service provider or really dig into things at that point.
Yeah, no, that's a really important note. I mean, I think going back to your comment about, you know, the actual benchmark, I kind of mentioned those different options. It's really important for you to get for the committee to get a benchmark that is a little bit more universal so that you're making sure that you're looking at plans with all different service providers, with all different, you know, again, with the same demographics and the same size and all that. And you just want to look at what is the universe that is being used to benchmark your plan, because that's going to be a really important factor on whether or not your benchmark is going to be considered relevant or even, you know, if you did it at all. So, for example, you could go online, you could get a free benchmark, but it may be absolutely meaningless because it includes all plans. And I think when you go online, you get these free benchmarks. A lot of plans actually come out lower because than they expected because the universe is all plans. So it's just really important that the first step when you decide, okay, we're going to go ahead and do the benchmark, what is the benchmark? What is the demographics? What is the universe? And how relevant is it to our plan? Some people even go within the same employer. Like if they're in real retail, they may benchmark it against other retail plans and things like that. I mean, you can get pretty specific as to, you know, how you want to benchmark it, but you just have to really make sure you're looking at what are those statistics. The other thing is, yeah, I mean, a lot of times we get to the process of, you know, and the benchmark process is not an easy process. I don't want anyone to walk away to think that, oh, it's the perfect alternative to an RFP, because when you do a benchmark, whoever you're going to do it with, you still have to provide them with a whole, all the demographic, the census information. It is still quite a bit of work if you're doing it right. It is still quite a bit of work on the HR folks, so there is going to be this information gathering requirement. So what do you do when you get it? You don't just, you know, the worst thing somebody could do is get it and stick it in their, you know, okay, well, look, we came out low or even mid. Well, you really have to evaluate the services that you're getting and where, you know, the fees kind of line up. And there's been instances where even though the fees came in a little bit lower, they still were not receiving all the services that they needed. So as a result of that, they actually went out for an RFP to see what other kind of services that they wanted and could get. And going on the other spectrum is, yeah, maybe the fees came in a little bit high, but that service provider is providing, you know, different kinds of services to the plan and the participants that are really important, and it's something that the plan committee really needs to be able to satisfy their fiduciary responsibility.
So yeah, this is where it gets us back to the whole process, and documenting the process. So you've done whether you've done the RFP or you've done the benchmarking, you want to make sure the committee's reviewing, discussing, considering the information, making decision, and then documenting that in the committee minutes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think I remember once I had a DOL investigation, this is going back maybe 2-3 years ago, and there had been some changes. Interestingly, not, you know, different service providers, it was on the record keeper, but it had gone from, it was a merger of the record keepers, so one name to another name. And so the DOL wanted to see, well, what was the kind of process of, you know, changing from one to the other, because the other actually, I think the fees came out a little bit higher, and the DOL noted that and wanted to, well, you know, and we have the documentation because, well, you know, we did the benchmark and, you know, the committee considered it, and they actually wanted a copy of the benchmark. It was an interesting, they wanted to see where the service provider ended up, and fortunately, due to the expertise of us here at Drinker Biddle, we had helped them document.
Shameless plug.
Yeah, you know, what can I say? By now, you should know who had the copy. But anyway, I digress, of course. But no, in all seriousness, though, we were able to, they had, you know, as part of the benchmark process, put together special committee meeting minutes talking about what was presented to them, their analysis of that information, and the ultimate decision that had come about of that, and that is what was provided to the Department of Labor, and that was perfectly fine, and there was no follow-up questions. So, you know, again, it's just kind of, we started with it. We're going to end with it. The whole idea of your process and documenting your process, and those are the really important things that we're hoping everybody walks away here with.
One other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is as you're picking the service provider, you know, obviously you're benchmarking fees, you're comparing fees, but you want to also think about how those fees are charged. One of the things we've been seeing in cases recently is where, you know, typically, at least on the record keeper side, it might be a per participant charge, or else you see an asset under management charge. There's no correct or right or wrong way between those two, but that's another important factor for the committee to consider when they're deciding on that service provider. There has been some litigation saying that assets under management doesn't work because then you get the situation where you're paying a fee, but the fee goes up as the accounts go up, but are you really getting more services for that increased fee? Ways to address that are either charging a per participant fee or renegotiating that asset under management fee periodically so that, yes, assets have gone up and so the fee would otherwise go up, but you renegotiate it back down since they're not doing anything more than they were doing before. So that's another way to address that per participant. You know, there's kind of issues with that as well. Some committees don't like the idea of everybody paying the same amount, or you've got a small plan, a small account versus a large account, and they're all paying the same amount. So there's pluses and minuses with both, but again, there's no right or wrong. It's a matter of making sure the committee's considering that information as part of its decision as well. And again, documenting that. And considering revenue sharing, you know, that's another one that I think is kind of almost a dirty word these days. But again, it's not wrong if you have revenue sharing or use the revenue sharing to pay some of the fees, but you want to make sure that that's been part of that fiduciary decision and been considered. Alternatively, the approach I think we've been seeing more and more people use is to have revenue sharing amounts credited back to the participants' accounts that generated the revenue sharing in the first place to kind of put everybody on an even playing field from that perspective.
Yeah.
So that's another aspect to consider as you're considering your service providers and the fees and all of those issues.
And I think one of the issues, too, service providers will, you know, you need to ask about is, you know, are they able to allocate back to participants? Are they able to carry a revenue sharing account, an ERISA account, expense account? I know one of the issues, too, is, you know, there's been this trend. You know, it used to always be revenue sharing. That used to be kind of, you know, how some of the fees, especially for the investment advisors, in my experience, had worked. And then there started to be this trend more, I think, probably arising out of litigation as to should we as plan committee members be talking about per participant fees. Well, then you have the whole idea of, you know, all of a sudden, participants who thought there was no fees in the plan.
Which was never really the case.
Which was never the case, but they never understood exactly where those fees were coming from. Now, all of a sudden, and especially with 404A5, they're seeing on their statements, we're paying a fee. And then there was kind of this next generation of discussions of, okay, well, if we do a per-participant fee, but maybe there's some revenue sharing coming back, and then can we allocate that just to the participants who are participating in those investments that are getting the revenue sharing allocated back? So there's so many different levels of, so many layers of participant fee issues that, you know, if that's something where you have a very sophisticated committee that really wants to make sure everything is being allocated correctly and really want to dig into that, can that service provider do that? Because sometimes there are limitations on systems and what they can and cannot do. So that's a very important notation, and thanks for raising that, Summer, because, again, that also can help if you do that in-person RFP. You can actually ask them, are you able to do that, and how can you do that, and what are your, you know, limitations on that?
Well, I guess should we turn it over? We have a few minutes left. Should we turn it over to see if there's any questions? Kelly, can you help us with that?
And at this time, if you do have a question, that will be star 1. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate once your line has been opened to ask your question. And again, that is star 1.
And well, while we're waiting for you, we get one already?
We do have a couple, but do you want to go ahead and take them?
Sure.
Okay, we'll take our first caller. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, this is Mark Lorette. Thanks for your very helpful insights on the RFP process today. I'm an advisor in the Bay Area in California, and I was curious about that RFP you mentioned where you had kept the RFP, the benchmarking, and what size plan was that with the DOL was, you know, digging into the details on that like that?
I think it was about, at the time, 3,000 participants with, I think, maybe $110
million
in assets.
Okay.
So it was a fairly large, but I'm going to tell you right now, with the DOL, it's not mattering anymore about plan sizes. We're seeing
small
plans and large plans, you know, get audited. But, yeah, at that time it was a fairly large plan, which is why they had, you know, they had the beauty of us being involved, and they had a wonderful investment advisor firm. So all of that stuff was done, you know, appropriately. But again, it's not just limited to those bigger
not plans. Those bigger plans they're limited to. Yeah, and I've had a couple of clients have DOL audits the last 2 years, and you know, we were fortunately we were very well prepared and had a fiduciary file And they did, you know, they asked for a lot of stuff that you might not expect them. They're not limiting it to, you know, to payroll, you know, timeliness. They're, yeah, they're looking at, they want the minutes and committee minutes and a lot of documentation. So it's helpful to hear that they're, what they're looking at in terms of RFPs. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks,
well, thank you. Okay.
We'll take our next question. Caller, please go ahead.
Oh, hi. I was interested in the comment you made regarding fees charged to assets under management. Maybe we're just in the fortunate position that may be unusual, but actually as assets under management increase, our fees decrease with our record keeper. So I was just kind of curious, is that it not normal in the industry?
So it was kind of built in that as they went up, it would go down? In your original agreement?
Yes.
Okay. I personally haven't seen that. That certainly sounds to me like a way to address that concern. So what I have had, I've had clients who just renegotiated it periodically, but if you've got it built in, then that kind of takes away the renegotiation. You obviously still want to make sure you're monitoring the plan to make sure that it continues to make sense, but that sounds like a way to kind of address some of those concerns from an asset under management standpoint.
I mean, it's interesting that the fees went down. I mean, I've seen it where, okay, you know, the fees will remain the same.
Oh, no, I apologize. I'm sorry. It's not that. It's the basis point. I'm sorry. The basis points charged against them go down.
Right. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
That is actually very common.
Okay. Yeah. And so then really now I get the point is your total fees could go up. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
I think with that, we are at our, actually, we're a little past our limit, so just a little quick housekeeping. We will have a recording of this presentation, you know, in case you just didn't get enough and want to listen to us again. That will be emailed to all the registrants and posted on our website, drinkerbiddle.com, under Insight and Events. And Heather and I enjoy doing these breakfast chats with you all, and so we will keep doing them and keep an eye out for the invitation for our next session. With that, go off and enjoy your day.
Oh, and if you guessed who was drinking the coffee, it was Heather.
You win a Drinker Biddle stamp.
There you go.
All right, everybody. Thanks, everyone. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
That will conclude today's conference. Again, thank you all for joining us.